Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. And as probably all of you have noticed who've watched anything on the evening news, life has gotten complicated, particularly if you're in the energy markets. Our first article deals with just that. It is from the Associated Press and Fortune magazine, joint authorship. The title of the article is Understanding Iran's Strait of Hormuz and Why Europe May Be Facing a Ukraine-like Energy Crisis Again. The United States says it's destroyed more than a dozen mine-laying Iranian vessels to prevent any attempt to close the Strait of Hormuz, highlighting the important role the narrow passageway plays in the global energy supply. The war in Iran has ground tanker traffic through the Strait of Hormuz to a halt, and oil prices have been swinging sharply, highlighting the important role the narrow passageway plays in global energy supply as the Islamic Republic vowed to block the region's oil exports, saying it would not allow even a single liter to be shipped to its enemies. President Donald Trump also said in social media posts that there were no reports of Iran planting mines in the Strait of Hormuz, the mouth of the Persian Gulf through which 20% of the world's oil and natural gas is shipped. Any disruption to traffic through the Strait of Hormuz affects the oil trade, and several ships in and around it have come under attack from Iran during the war. Fears about the strait caused oil to spike on Monday, only for it to swiftly fall back after Trump suggested the war could be near an end. The scale of what is at stake cannot be overstated, said Hakan Kaya, senior portfolio manager and investment manager firm Neuberger Berman. He said a partial slowdown last week or two could be absorbed by oil companies, but a full or near full closure lasting a month or more would push crude oil prices well into triple digits and European natural gas prices toward or above the crisis level seen in 2022. Here's what to know about the Strait and the widening Iran war. The Strait is a key waterway for global shipping. The Strait of Hormuz is a bending waterway about 33 kilometers, 21 miles, wide at its narrowest point. It connects the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Oman. From there, ships can then travel to the rest of the world. While Iran and Oman have their territorial waters in the Strait, it's viewed as an international waterway that all ships can ply. The UAE, home to the skyscraper-studded city of Dubai, also sits near the waterway. The Strait has long been important for trade. The Strait of Hormuz, through history, has been important for trade, with ceramics, ivory, silk, and textiles moving from China through the region. In the modern era, it is the route of supertankers carrying oil and gas from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Qatar, Bahrain, the UAE, and Iran. The vast majority of it goes to markets in Asia, including Iran's only remaining oil customer, China. While there are pipelines in Saudi Arabia and the UAE that can avoid the passage, the U.S. Energy Information Administration says most volumes that transit the strait have no alternative means of exiting the region. Threats to the region have spiked global energy prices in the past, including during the Israel-Iran war in June. Is the strait closed? Iran has attacked several ships in the Strait of Hormuz and threatened any ships that attempt to pass through, effectively but not officially closing it. Trump said on social media that the U.S. would dramatically increase attacks if Iran tried to close the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has been targeting energy infrastructure and traffic through the strait. Previously, Iran temporarily shut down parts of the strait in mid-February for what it said was a military drill. In past times of tension and conflict, Iran has at times harassed shipping through the Narrows, and during the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, both sides attacked tankers and other vessels, using naval mines to completely shut down traffic at points. But Iran, up until now, has not carried out repeated threats to close the waterway altogether. Since then, even during last year's 12-day war, when Israel and the U.S. bombarded Iran's key nuclear and military sites. The U.S. is rolling out ship reinsurance in the region through the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, a government agency that partners with the private sector to back global investment projects in an effort to get ships moving through the strait again. Political risk insurance is a type of coverage intended to protect firms against financial losses caused by unstable political conditions, government actions, or violence. Marine insurers have been canceling or raising rates for insurance in the region. The U.S. reinsurance facility will insure losses up to approximately $20 billion on a rolling basis, according to the International Development Finance Corporation, focusing on insuring cargo and physical damage to a ship's structure and operating machinery to start. Trump said that, if necessary, the U.S. Navy would escort oil tankers through the strait, though that has yet to happen. There is a French-led initiative in the works that would involve European and non-European nations helping to escort tankers with the aim of gradually reopening the strait as soon as possible after the most intense phase of the conflict is over. On Tuesday, Trump said the U.S. military completely destroyed 16 inactive Iranian mine-laying ships. Trump, in his social media post, added that there would be more to follow, suggesting the U.S. would target additional mine-laying vessels. The announcement of the targeting of the ships came soon after two other social media posts by the U.S. president, in which he said he has no reports of Iran putting explosive mines in the strategic waterway, but also warned Tehran if mines were laid, he wanted them immediately removed. Global shippers have issued service alerts, saying they've suspended operations in the area. Danish shipping company Maersk, the world's biggest shipping company, said Sunday it is suspending all vessel crossings in the Strait of Hormuz until further notice. Other ocean carriers, including Hapag-Lloyd, CMA CGM, and MSC, made similar announcements. Those ships that got stuck in the Gulf are not going anywhere, said Tom Goldsby, logistics chairman in the Supply Chain Management Department of the University of Tennessee. There's also a whole host of ships that were heading into the Gulf to replace them, and of course they're anchored or going elsewhere now. There are currently about 400 oil and product tankers idle in the Gulf, and one oil tanker passed through the Strait of Hormuz without incident on Monday, according to data from the website Marine Traffic. Here's another article on the energy implications of the Iran conflict from Fortune magazine and Bloomberg, dated March 9th. Title of the article is, Oil Market Chaos to Deepen as More Gulf Giants Cut Output. The chaos that's gripped the oil market looks set to deepen, with more production getting cut as the war in Iran effectively shuts down the Strait of Hormuz and the U.S. considers widening its range of targets in the country. The United Arab Emirates and Kuwait have already started reducing oil production as storage runs out, joining Iraq, whose output is now down 60%. Others may be forced to follow as oil tankers continue avoiding the narrow waterway, rapidly reducing the number of empty ones available for loading. Once all the vessels are loaded, the region's remaining on-land storage will fill even quicker. The upheaval, now on its ninth day, shows no sign of imminent resolution, meaning a strip of water that normally handles a fifth of the world's oil is impassable. Saudi Arabia is diverting record amounts of crude to its Red Sea coast for export, helping to alleviate at least some of the pressure. Iran has vowed not to back down in the face of U.S. and Israeli strikes that began on February 28. President Donald Trump responded on Saturday by saying the U.S. would now consider targeting areas and groups of people in Iran that were not previously aimed for. The attacks will continue until they surrender or, more likely, completely collapse, he said in a social media post. For oil analysts, executives, and traders, that has meant ever louder warnings that the war is bringing crude to a tipping point and closer to the psychological $100 a barrel threshold. As an aside, at the time of this recording, which is 11 a.m. on the 11th of March, Brent crude price is $92 a barrel. Brent already climbed 30%, its biggest jump in 6 years, putting it just dollars from that mark. Other markers tied closely to the region have already soared through that level. Futures tied to Abu Dhabi's flagship Murban crude closed at $103 a barrel on Friday, while Oman crude futures were at $107. Chinese crude oil futures on the Shanghai International Energy Exchange ended in U.S. dollar terms at $109. Every additional day of disruption adds pressure, and in that scenario, there is effectively no ceiling to prices in the short term, said Stefano Grasso, a one-time physical energy trader who's now senior portfolio manager at Singapore-based fund 8 Vantage APTE. For one, there are growing threats to oil infrastructure, raising the risk of disruptions that could outlast attacks in the area. Saudi Arabia intercepted drones that were heading toward the million-barrel-a-day Shaiba oil field over the weekend. Strikes in Bahrain and Qatar have also continued. There is also the continued blockage of the Strait of Hormuz. Over the past days, only Iran-linked tankers and two bulk carriers, which claim to be Chinese-owned, have been seen transiting. The effective closure has led to Iraq's pumping dropping to about 1.7 to 1.8 million barrels a day, down from about 4.3 million a day in pre-conflict times, according to people with knowledge of the matter. Saudi Arabia, meanwhile, is directing unprecedented amounts of crude to its Red Sea coast. Shipments from its western terminals have surged to a rate of about 2.3 million barrels a day so far this month, ship tracking data compiled by Bloomberg show. While that's about 50% more than the kingdom has shipped from Red Sea in any month since the end of 2016, it's far below the 6 million barrels a day that the country has exported from the Persian Gulf in recent months. The U.S. has promised to bolster financial protection and potentially provide military escorts, and it announced on Friday that we'd roll out maritime reinsurance for the Persian Gulf region. The facility will cover losses up to $20 billion on a rolling basis, according to a statement. For ship owners and charterers operating in the region, however, the cost of insurance is not the major concern holding up traffic. Instead, they worry about the safety of vessels and crew and say they would need full naval escort along the lines of Operation Prosperity Guardian, a coalition to safeguard shipping in the Red Sea, or preferably an end to hostilities. Other U.S. moves to dampen oil price increases include allowing India to access Russian oil currently held in floating storage in the region. Washington has also floated tapping its strategic petroleum reserve or even intervening in futures markets. Officials have since downplayed these ideas, while Trump has brushed off inflammatory worries even as U.S. gas prices spike. "This is an excursion," he said on Saturday. "We figured oil prices would go up, which they will. They'll also come down, and they'll come down very fast. Import-dependent Asia, which leans heavily on the Middle East, is feeling the most immediate pain. In Japan, which takes over 90% of its crude from the region, refiners are asking for the option of drawing on national oil reserves. Others, including China, have curbed fuel exports to preserve supply and keep domestic prices controlled. South Korea is considering reinstating an oil price cap for the first time in 30 years, state news agency Yonhap reported on Tuesday, cited by government officials. In northwestern Europe, meanwhile, the price of jet fuel soared to an all-time high of $1,528 a ton, the equivalent of more than $190 a barrel, on Thursday, according to figures from General Index that go back to 2008. The impact on jet fuel is particularly sharp because half of the European Union's imports typically pass through Hormuz. For analysts at ING Group NV, the base case is now 4 weeks of disruption, two of full upheaval, 2 weeks at 50%, said Warren Patterson, the bank's head of commodity strategy in Singapore. This scenario doesn't necessarily mean that we see a full end to the conflict in this time period, he said. But if U.S. and Israeli strikes degrade Iran's ability to attack vessels and enforce a closure of the Strait of Hormuz, we could see flows starting to normalize. The bank's most drastic scenario is a three-month full disruption to oil and liquefied natural gas flows. This would likely see oil prices spiking to records through the second quarter, the bank's analysts wrote in a note. So we've talked about the energy markets. Let's talk about the effect of the conflict on the Federal Reserve and its stance on inflation. This is from Fortune magazine by Eleanor Pringle, dated March 11th. The title is, Trump may claim the war is complete, but Wall Street expects the Fed to stay hawkish on its effect long after the conflict has ended. While President Trump managed to calm markets somewhat this week by saying the U.S. and Israel's war with Iran is very complete, pretty much, those assurances from the Oval Office will likely do little to unwind the hawkish stance of the world's central banks. The conflict in the Middle East sent all oil prices spiraling to more than $100 a barrel over the weekend, with consumers in the Western world panic buying supplies. Oil and energy prices are a key factor in inflation expectations for households, and the reality of any price surges in the commodity increases readings for core inflation data. This is the concern of a central bank, many of which are mandated to keep prices stable. In countries like the U.S., the Fed even has an inflation target of 2% to maintain. Already, sticky inflation is ahead of where the Federal Reserve would like it to be. The latest CPI reading from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, was 2.4% over the past 12 months, with some categories such as food and energy services well above that level. Any upward pressure impacting the finances of households and businesses will work against calls for a lower base rate, an argument President Trump and his cabinet have been making for the past year. But Trump is likely to be disappointed. Macquarie strategists Thierry Wiseman and Gareth Barry say that even if the war in Iran does quickly draw to a close, it will be months before central banks feel confident that its inflationary impacts have subsided. President Trump's suggestion that the war will resolve very soon may have been merely a reflection of Iran's degraded capacity to fight back, rather than a tactical retreat by the U.S., the duo observed in a note to clients this week. If so, we can still expect hostilities will wind down, but around month end, not now. That's still time to cause psychic damage to investors, consumers, and adversely affect economic data for the April release cycle in May. Question marks over the pass-through of higher oil prices to consumers will loom large at the Federal Open Market Committee's rate-setting meeting next week. The factors contributing to the rise in oil prices are also not easily rectified. Iran borders the Strait of Hormuz, a narrow waterway in the Persian Gulf, through which exports from the UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, and Iraq will flow. Shipmasters are now nervous to sail through it. As well as sourcing insurance guarantees for shipmasters, the White House has offered military escorts to ships along the strait in order to keep the route open. Energy Secretary Chris Wright claimed on social media yesterday that a U.S. Navy vessel had escorted an oil tanker down the strait, though this post was later deleted, with White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt later confirming the military had not provided such an escort. Almost all central banks will tilt to the hawkish side of the rhetorical spectrum, while oil prices stay high, added the Macquarie strategists. They continued, "We would expect that this more hawkish disposition persists after the hostilities end, largely because the data may continue to point to inflationary pressures, and hence a shift in public expectations throughout the period in which inflation may show up in the data, i.e., through the May reporting cycle." Inflation is only one half of the Fed's mandate. The other half is maintaining stable employment. Investors seem relatively convinced that it is the inflation side of the mandate that the Fed will focus on and are pricing out a cut as a result. Per CME's FedWatch barometer, speculators are pricing in more than a 99% chance of a hold at the next meeting. However, Bank of America's Aditya Bhave suggests markets are misreading the Fed's likely response to oil price increases. In a note released yesterday, B of A's senior economist noted supply shocks create risks to both sides of the Fed's dual mandate, with the employment outlook remaining sluggish. The most recent jobs report from the BLS showed non-farm payroll employment edged down by 92,000 in February, with the unemployment rate at 4.4%. Policy risks play out when demand is strong enough for activity to withstand a supply shock, he explained. This allows the Fed to focus on inflation as it did in 22. But when Russia invaded Ukraine, the U rate was below 4%. Core PCE inflation was over 5%. Payrolls were running at 500K a month, and consumers were flush with COVID stimulus cash. By contrast, we now have a soft labor market, moderately elevated inflation, and a more modest fiscal support. This sets up a more dovish Fed response if the oil shock is persistent. All right, enough about oil and conflicts. Let's go to an article from Fortune magazine by Sean Tully about SpaceX. The title of the article is, "To Justify a $1.5 Trillion Market Cap After Its IPO, SpaceX Would Need to Earn More Than Berkshire Hathaway. Today, it earns zero." This article is dated March 10th, 2026. Reports are swirling that Elon Musk is planning an IPO for SpaceX this summer. Now that Musk has merged the rocket enterprise with XAI, another pillar of his empire, he expects the combination to raise $50 billion in capital and garner a market cap of $1.5 trillion. At those numbers, SpaceX would notch the single biggest IPO capital raise of all time, and also rank as second highest in total valuation to Saudi Aramco, and far ahead of second place Alibaba's introduction in 2018 at $167 million. Until SpaceX publishes its prospectus for the offering, we won't have a detailed look at its financials, We do, however, have important snippets of information. Musk has stated that SpaceX generated some $15 billion in revenue last year, and it's been widely reported that it booked roughly $8 billion in EBITDA. The scenario circulating widely in the media, and not refuted by Musk, shows a loss of $2.4 billion for the first 9 months of 2025. These numbers don't include interest and depreciation, the latter compromising SpaceX's outlays for plants and equipment. Knitting together this limited view of the now united businesses, it appears likely that the current SpaceX is showing zero or even negative GAAP earnings. Hence, SpaceX can't be valued on its current profits, but only on its prospects of gigantic growth in the most pioneering of industries whose future trajectory is also unknowable. However, we do know two things about SpaceX that should give investors big worries about a $1.5 trillion valuation. The first, these are the ultimate in capital-intensive enterprises. Musk announced SpaceX's intention to build 10,000 fully reusable rockets, each over 400 feet tall, at a cost that Payload Research estimates at $35 million each. That's $350 billion in cash for the likes of methane, LOX Raptors, solar arrays, and stainless steel alloy. XAI is a major builder of high-cost data centers that run such projects as its Grok chatbot. In 2025, it reportedly burned through $8 billion in cash, primarily to fund such behemoths as its $20 billion micro-hardware facility in Mississippi. The upshot, these aren't low-investment software plays that, if successful, could easily post 35% net GAAP margins. In general, it's extremely rare for manufacturers, whether it's an aircraft or a data generator, to achieve such lofty levels of profitability. The second known are the earnings of SpaceX must produce to reward shareholders going forward. Keep in mind, it's beginning at a standing start, given its apparent lack of current earnings. Where does SpaceX need to be in 5 years? This is the riskiest of bets. Looking at what investors demand from similarly risky enterprises, let's estimate shareholders will want total returns of at least 10% a year to hold the stock. Hence, by 2031, its market cap must grow to at least $2.4 trillion to ring the bell. That's bigger than all but four of the world's biggest companies today, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Apple, and far larger than Meta Platforms and Saudi Aramco, and $1.2 trillion bigger than Musk's flagship, Tesla. We'll assume it will then merit a price-to-earnings multiple of 30, the median for the Magnificent Seven. At our $2.4 trillion cap, the bogey for GAAP net earnings towers at $80 billion a year. That's 33% more than Meta, 21% above Berkshire Hathaway, and about two-thirds the numbers for Alphabet and Apple. Whether SpaceX can get there is really a moonshot, says Jack Cieselski, one of America's leading accounting experts. If anybody's guess how big the space industry will become in the future, SpaceX could get there, but it will need two things: an extremely fast-growing market and significant monopoly power. It already faces a number of smaller competitors, including Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin. SpaceX's best chance is developing a huge lead that gives its economy of scales and rocket production that no competitor can match. The chances of that happening are highly uncertain, while the gigantic price you'll pay as a shareholder to ride the rocket and hope it soars, not sputters, is preset. According to media accounts, SpaceX is planning its own stock market launch to coincide with a rare planetary event when Jupiter and Venus appear close together in the sky. The best bet is that SpaceX proves a scientific triumph, but star-crossed as a stock. Now we're going to change topics totally. This article is from Fortune magazine. It's by Alan Richer, and it's dated March 10th, 2026. Have any of you ever noticed how expensive live events would be, concerts and plays? They're very, very expensive. So expensive that the Department of Justice looked into the issue. The title of this article is "The Department of Justice Strikes Tentative Ticketmaster Settlement as States Break Away to Continue to Fight Live Nation." It's from Fortune magazine. The Justice Department said Monday that it's tentatively settled its antitrust lawsuit against Ticketmaster and parent company Live Nation Entertainment, striking a deal to ultimately lower ticket prices for consumers and end an illegal monopoly over live events in America. But some states signaled they won't join the deal and will continue an ongoing trial. After the Justice Department announced the deal at the start of the trial day in Manhattan federal court, Judge Aaron Subramanian called it entirely unacceptable that no one informed him of the tentative deal until late Sunday. A term sheet for the expected settlement was signed on Thursday, he said. A senior Justice Department official, though, spoke effusively of the looming settlement on the condition of anonymity Monday during a phone call with journalists under terms set by the department to release some information about the proposed settlement. Live Nation would pay a fine of up to $280 million and it divest itself of at least 13 amphitheaters across the country as it opens up its ticketing process so that competitors can share in the sale of tickets, the official said. The official called it a win-win for everybody that will bring immediate relief for consumers and protect venues from retaliation when they choose companies other than Live Nation to handle tickets or promotion for the events. A double-digit number of states were expected to join the proposed deal, the official said. New York attorney Letitia James said in a statement, "The Justice Department deal fails to address the monopoly at the center of this case," and that she would not agree to it. "My attorney general colleagues and I have a strong case against Live Nation, and we will continue our lawsuit to protect consumers and restore fair competition to the live entertainment industry," James said. A release containing her statements said New York State was joined in its decision to continue pursuing claims by attorney generals in Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Kansas, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, Wisconsin, Wyoming, and the District of Columbia. In a release, Washington State Attorney General Nick Brown said the bipartisan group of state attorneys general who joined the Justice Department's lawsuit in May 2024 would continue because the case against Live Nation is strong and the state coalition is committed to holding the company accountable for its illegal behavior, protecting customers, and restoring competition to this market. Adam Gitlin, a lawyer for the District of Columbia, said Subramanian that several states had not decided what they would do, including Texas, Florida, and Louisiana. He said Texas had expressed serious concerns about the deal. Gitlin requested a mistrial on Monday, a week after opening statements, but David Marriott, a lawyer for Live Nation, opposed the request. The judge informed the jury of the proposed deal and told jurors that certain states are proceeding with their claims, and the trial was expected to resume next week. Live Nation didn't immediately respond to a request by the Associated Press for comment. "The continuation of the trial will leave the states to press claims to further dismantle a monopoly the Justice Department said was squelching competition and driving prices up for fans. The case, brought under President Joe Biden's administration in 2024, accused Live Nation of using threats, retaliation, and other tactics to suffocate the competition by controlling virtually every aspect of the industry, from concert promotion to ticketing. The Justice Department accused Live Nation of engaging in a slew of practices that have allowed it to maintain a stranglehold over the live music scene. It said the company uses long-term contracts to keep venues from choosing rival ticketers, blocking venues from using multiple ticket sellers, and threatening venues that they would lose money and fans if they didn't choose Ticketmaster. Live Nation has maintained that artists and teams set prices and decide how tickets are sold. Ticketmaster and Live Nation Entertainment, based in Beverly Hills, California, have a long history of clashes with major artists and their fans, including Taylor Swift and Bruce Springsteen. Ticketmaster, which was established in 1976 and merged with Live Nation in 2010, is the world's largest ticket seller across live music, sports, theater, and more. If you're a McDonald's fan, our next article is good news for you. This is from Forbes magazine. It's written by Antonio Pequeño IV, and it's dated March 12th. McDonald's is launching $3 menu items to keep lower-income customers, report says. McDonald's will soon launch discounted menu items and cheaper breakfast deals, according to the Wall Street Journal, making the push for value as fast food chains around the country try to maintain lower-income customers hit by inflation and priced out of dining options that are typically budget-friendly. McDonald's will launch the new deals next month. Here are the key facts. McDonald's will introduce items that cost $3 or less, the Journal reported, citing unnamed people familiar with discussions around the deals. The push for increased value will also include $4 breakfast meal deals, according to the Journal, which said the new items will launch in April and noted McDonald's morning offerings have seen the largest drop from lower-income customers. The $4 meal deal will include options such as a McMuffin, hash brown, and a coffee, while the $3 and less menu will include sausage biscuits or four-piece chicken McNuggets, replacing the buy one, add one for a dollar menu. The move comes months after McDonald's relaunched Extra Value Meals in September that offered a $5 sausage McMuffin with egg meal that came with hash browns and a small coffee, as well as an $8 Big Mac meal that included medium fries and a medium drink. Here's a big number for you, $7 billion. That is how much revenue McDonald's generated in its latest quarter, while U.S. same-store sales increased by 6.8%. The fast food chain did not disclose how much the reintroduction of extra value meals impacted its earnings, though it is possible that the offerings found success as McDonald's looks to incorporate more savings options for diners. McDonald's is one of several chains that's seen a drop-off of lower-income diners in recent quarters. Last year, Chipotle CEO Scott Boatwright said households making less than $100,000, which make up 40% of Chipotle's total sales, were not dining out as often, with the demographic of 25 to 35-year-olds seeing the biggest slump. Similar to McDonald's, Wendy's recorded drops in breakfast sales last year, with CEO Ken Cook telling investors, "When consumer uncertainty increases and consumers choose to eat another meal at home, breakfast is often the first place that they begin that with." McDonald's recorded a 3.6% decline in U.S. same-store sales in the first quarter of 2025, which was partially driven by a 10% decrease in visits from low- and middle-income households. The chain's average cost for a menu item jumped 40% from 2019 to 2024, which McDonald's has said aligns with meeting higher wages, cost increases, and pricier food. CEO Christopher Kempczinski told investors in McDonald's third quarter earnings call that traffic from the lower income diners dropped nearly double figure digits industry-wide, noting higher grocery and apparel prices affecting their outlook and their sentiment and their spending behavior. However, the chain is scoring some wins despite the challenge. As Kempczinski said, McDonald's logged a 5.5% jump in sales growth in the fourth quarter, contributing to $140 billion in system-wide sales in 2025. Here's an update on the dispute between Anthropic and the Department of War. It's from Fortune magazine, dated 3/10/2026. Anthropic is suing the Department of War and other federal agencies after the Trump administration formally designated the company a supply chain risk late last week. The lawsuit, filed Monday in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, calls the administration's actions unprecedented and unlawful, and the claims they threaten to harm Anthropic irreparably. It's the latest development in an ongoing disagreement between Pentagon and Anthropic over the Trump administration's use of its AI technology, with big implications for the control of AI overall and the relationship between business and government. Anthropic had refused Pentagon demands to remove contractual restrictions on using its AI for domestic mass surveillance and autonomous weapons, prompting the administration to cancel the company's government contracts and label it a national security risk. An Anthropic spokesman told Fortune that seeking judicial review does not change our long-standing commitment to harnessing AI to protect our national security. But this is a necessary step to protect our business, our customers, and our partners. We will continue to pursue every path toward resolution, including dialogue with the government. Legal experts have already questioned whether the designation is likely to hold up in court. Lawyers Michael Andreas and Alan J. Rosenstein called it political theater, a show of force that will not stick, arguing that the government cannot credibly claim an emergency threat while simultaneously planning a six-month phase-out of the technology. Lest anyone think this fight has shifted entirely to the courtroom, though, Axios reported late Monday that President Trump is considering issuing an executive order to eradicate Anthropic from the federal government. Forbes magazine is the source of our next article. It's by Brandon Kochkoden. It's dated March 9, 2026. Title of the article is No AI Plan, No Loan. Small business lenders force Main Street to face the future. Ray Drew was reviewing a loan application from an online trip planning business last month and started to worry its service looked uncomfortably close to something an AI chatbot could do in minutes or seconds. He passed on the loan. As the founder of SBA Collective, a network of lenders and advisors focused on Small Business Administration-backed lending, Drew has been having discussions about the impact of artificial intelligence on small business since 2023. But now the talk is more frequent and much more direct. He's bringing it up with borrowers and would-be borrowers of $5 billion in assets, Winston-Salem, North Carolina-based Truliant Federal Credit, where he's managing director of SBA Lending. We have to at least ask the question, how is AI disrupting your business? There's really not a single industry where you don't need to ask that question, says Drew. Investors, economists, and ordinary Americans are understandably obsessed with the pros and cons and the winners and losers from the advance of artificial intelligence. Much of the financial focus has been on the impact on workers, as big companies attribute layoffs, accurately or not, to AI, and on Silicon Valley, as investors try to figure out which software companies are themselves about to get disrupted. The $9 billion iShares Expanded Tech Software Sector ETF has fallen some 20% this year as markets wrestle with the changes underway and on the way. What has received far less attention is how the same uncertainty is playing out on Main Street among accountants, consultants, law firms, and other businesses, and the small banks that make decisions about financing them every day. The stakes are high. Firms with fewer than 500 employees account for about 44% of U.S. GDP and employ 46% of the private workforce, or more than 62 million Americans. A good chunk of those small businesses operate in fields where generative AI appears most useful. A 2025 Microsoft research paper analyzing hundreds of thousands of AI interactions found the technology is, unsurprisingly, most applicable to tasks involved writing, research, and analysis. One-third of small employer firms are in professional services and real estate, a single category, or business support services, according to the Federal Reserve's Small Business Credit Survey. Sure, most of the impact from AI may not be seen for years, but that's little comfort to small business lenders who typically make loans with a 10-year life. While the Small Business Administration backstops about 75% of a 7A loan, banks still absorb losses if a borrower fails and must show the agency they follow proper underwriting standards to collect the guarantee. Over the past decade, roughly 8% of SBA loans have defaulted on a cumulative basis, according to Lumos Data, a firm that analyzes SBA lending performance. Small business lending is as much an art as it is a science. The science is in the spreadsheets. Bankers analyze cash flow, review collateral, and check a potential borrower's credit history. The art is the harder part, judging whether the business itself makes sense and has long-term survival potential, given the high new business failure rate. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, just under 35% of the businesses started in 2013 were still around a decade later. Normally, bankers can draw on their own experience. For example, did similar businesses survive the last recession? But every so often, something comes along that doesn't resemble anything they've seen before, making forecasts harder than usual. A global pandemic, tariffs that appear, disappear, and appear again. AI is today's big unknown. So far, lenders are not pulling back from entire industries or predicting a wave of business failures. But the way they think about risk is starting to change. If a company's product is knowledge, advice, or analysis, as opposed to, say, installing and servicing heating and cooling units, lenders have to at least consider what happens when software starts doing more of that work. Some of the borrowers that banks thought they understood best are now harder for them to figure out. The result, bankers are increasingly demanding whether and how a small business loan applicant is thinking about and harnessing the disruptive impact of AI. Don't try to sweep it under the rug, advises Jeremy Gilpin, chairman of a $280 million in assets community bank shares in LaGrange, Georgia. Firms that treat AI as a taboo topic raise concerns, he says. Lenders assume employers are already experimenting with these tools. If a company claims it is not using AI at all, that can signal something worse. Either employees are experimenting with the tools without management realizing it, suggesting a lack of oversight, or the business is falling behind a technology reshaping its industry. Instead, Gilpin says borrowers should show how the technology fits into the business. If projections assume efficiency gains from AI, lenders want to see where those gains appear in the workflow. policies around data security, quality control, and employee use also come up more often. In some cases, lenders are asking to review those policies alongside the business plan. Handled well, exposure to AI does not automatically hurt a credit application. In some cases, it can strengthen one. Gilpin says lenders want to see owners who acknowledge the disruption and explain how their firm's plans to adapt to it. Legal work illustrates the tension between AI as a productivity tool and AI as a technology that could eventually replace some of the work lawyers bill for. Some attorneys already use AI tools to summarize case law or draft early versions of briefs. That can make the firms more productive. It can also compress the hours traditionally billed to clients. Lenders reviewing those firms are trying to understand how the economics will evolve as those tools spread. Plus, trying to sweep AI aside is unlikely to fool anyone. After all, small banks themselves are experimenting with the same tools and know how quickly they are improving. Chris Hearn, founder and CEO of Lendesca, a fintech that builds AI-driven software to help banks originate and process SBA loans, says many underwriters are already testing large language models to help them draft narratives and credit memos. Hearn says a credit memo that once took a week to produce can sometimes be drafted in 2 hours or less. As AI takes over more of the mechanical work of underwriting, lenders may have more time for the other half of the job, the art of judging whether a business will still work in the future. The more clerical the task, the more it has a bullseye on it, Hearn says. So far, lenders say they have not seen loans fail because artificial intelligence wiped out a borrower's business, but it's still early. Most of the impact so far is showing up in deal selection and diligence rather than in defaults. For borrowers, the takeaway is that clean financials, cash flow, and collateral still matter, but lenders increasingly want to understand how a business plans to operate in a world where software keeps getting better at doing what people used to do. In the end, that's the art of lending. We're going to finish today with a series of articles from Forbes magazine's Daily Update. There is no author on this article, but it is dated on the 12th of March, 2026. Google completed the largest purchase in its history, closing a $32 billion all-cash acquisition of Israeli cloud security startup Wiz. It's a major bet from the tech giant on cloud-based security, and the deal boosted Wiz's four co-founders, lifting their combined net worth to $9.2 billion. Shares of several major banks fell after Iran threatened to target financial institutions in the Middle East with links to the U.S. and Israel. Iranian news agencies said Wednesday that a building linked to one of the country's largest banks was hit overnight in an attack the Iranian military called illegitimate and unconventional. The next segment of the newsletter is titled, Tesla's Best Growth Story Isn't Robotaxis, It's Batteries. Tesla's era as the market's can't-miss EV growth engine has passed, cracking under tougher competition and softer demand. But while CEO Elon Musk keeps the stock aloft with robotaxi bloviating and Optimus cosplay, the company's energy arm is doing the one thing that Wall Street loves and hype can't fake, booking revenue. Inside Tesla's sprawling identity crisis, grid-scale batteries and potentially solar are the closest thing it now has to a can't-miss bet. It's their best business, said Tesla investor and frequent Musk critic Ross Gerber, CEO of California-based wealth management firm Gerber Kawasaki. For a decade, Tesla has packaged and sold battery cells in Powerwall packs for residential solar installations and much larger mega packs for utility-scale power storage. In 2025, the company's battery business booked a record $12.8 $1 billion of revenue, up 27%, while its annual auto revenues dropped 10% to $69.5 billion. Tesla is still overwhelmingly a car company by revenue, but the direction of travel is what matters. Energy is growing, autos are shrinking, and the macro backdrop suggests that the gap can widen. And now, with data centers straining utilities' capacity and pushing residential electricity prices higher, Tesla is also looking to return to solar panel manufacturing after earlier ambitions, including the solar roof, failed to meet expectations. Billions of dollars of additional revenue for Tesla from sales of energy products are helping to blunt the company's falling EV sales, still its top source of income, says Forbes senior writer Alan Onsman. While Musk wants to turn Tesla into a new company, leading in robo-taxis and humanoid robots, it's not at all clear when those will become profitable businesses. Continuing to expand battery pack production and as a meaningful player in the solar market, making its own panels, not just installing them, looks like a smart bet as energy demand spikes. And now a few words on inflation. Investors would typically welcome an inflation report like we got Wednesday, showing that consumer prices increased less than expected in February. Instead, they're bracing for the impact of the Iran war. Consumer prices rose by 2.4% year over year, beating consensus analyst estimates. But the data doesn't yet reflect the surge in gas prices since the start of the conflict, affecting not just drivers, but also the transportation sector. Still, the report does reveal evidence that tariffs are causing price jumps, explains Joe Bruswellis, chief economist at RSM. For example, apparel prices surged 1.3% month over month and 2.5% over year, the most since October 2023. Bruswellis expects a sharp jump in inflation in March, which further complicates the Federal Reserve's dual mandate of maximum employment and stable prices, especially after Friday's concerning jobs report. The central bank is widely expected to hold rates steady when it meets next week. I think we can now effectively rule out any rate cuts in the first half of the year, Bruswellis tells Forbes Daily. And with that, folks, we're done. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next Monday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.